Well, hello.
There we go. Woohoo!
Hey. Good morning.
Good morning. Oh my gosh, yeah.
This is, I apologize for being, I get kind of starting the time. Like, oh my gosh, it's already 7:30.
Oh, you're the one who was rush, late. Rush. Okay, yes. You're the one who was late. Okay, I'll take that. I had to reboot my computer, so.
Oh, okay. Well,
so I'm like, Bruce is probably wondering why I'm not answering. And I tried to answer. I even got an email from you already. You are so fast. Good morning, Bruce Rawls. Oh my goodness.
How's things in Pueblo?
You know, things are interesting. My grandkids are over and spend the night, and my granddaughter, who is like 20 months old, she did not go to sleep till after 1 o'clock this morning.
Oh.
She was just like. So, and her poor lady, her eyes were all red, and she looked all so tired, but she just kept going and going and going, and finally, she was just sitting there on the couch, and just like at 1 o'clock, at the stroke of the hour, all of a sudden, she just closed her eyes, and that was it. She was gone. But until then, Grandma had a good time because everybody else went to bed. So she and I were the only ones awake, and the whole it was hilarious. But so I didn't get a lot of sleep last night. And I what Jesus says in the Course of Miracles is that if you imagine or you think that you're tired is because you think you're capable of being tired, and that certainly is my experience. I do see myself as capable of being tired, and in fact, required to be tired.
That rhymes too.
Required to be tired.
Sounds like it could be the new lyrics to "Got a New Drug." Required to be tired.
Yeah, required to be tired. Yeah, well, you know that.
But that's the ego's thought system, and so we now all need to be really gentle with ourselves when we find ourselves, you know, weary and upset and judgmental and all that stuff, and the whole gamut, the whole spectrum of ego's, you know, experiences and thoughts and feelings and emotions, and just watch that and say, oh, that's my resistance to a love that's and a peace that's way beyond, you know, anything this world has to offer. And I think today's workbook lesson hints at that really nicely. I know you always like to enjoy, pulling in today's workbook lesson, but I think it fits really nicely, is that, you know, God being love is also happiness. So all those thoughts, feelings, and qualities of mind, peace, love, joy, happiness, you know, I mean, all sound like cliches, but those are really, you know, a non-dual, non-changing, eternal state that is our real being. And that's what awaits us, but you know, we have to ease into it because we're still so addicted to all the opposites, the seeming opposites of those that we've only made up only in our minds, and because our minds are so powerful, we've made up a whole world to accompany them and reinforce and substantiate and serve as propagandists for those thoughts and feelings and experiences. And boy, they seem real. I felt like I was tired last night when I went to bed. And
yeah.
After a long day of driving and looking at tulips and strange and interesting plants in a public garden in a place in Oregon away from where we live a little bit. So we made a little day trip out to avoid the another day of rain and... So anyway, that was our outing yesterday. We had a lot of fun, but because we think that there's certain things, you know, drain us, it's because the us is a body. We think we're capable of being tired. So, you know, that's pretty normal, and not to be hard on ourselves when we find ourselves in that kind of experience and realize, oh, well, I must have been identifying with a non-existent reality, and so. That's wearing. It takes an enormous amount of energy to maintain the belief in separation, as my friend.
It does.
Esco says, yeah.
Absolutely. And it's perceiving this gap that somehow there is a, like yesterday I was feeling so energetic, and I was having such a great time with those kids, and I had been doing a lot of exercising, and so I was feeling all great and good and everything, and then came about a gap in that great feeling, the idea that, you know, somehow or the other I was tired.
And how can that be possible?
And how can that be possible? I was just feeling so great a couple hours ago, and now all of a sudden I'm, you know, thinking I'm going to just have to lay down my head and go to sleep, and I can't do it because here's this little baby who's likely to do all kinds of stuff if, if I'm not here to make sure she doesn't. And so, you know, I thought I was filling in the gap. But really, you know, all I had to do was ask Jesus to, you know, give me a hand here and help me to fill this perceived gap in love, is a perceived gap in energy, is a perceived gap in finances, it's a perceived gap in health, it's a perceived gap in time, it's a perceived gap. I mean, everything that we perceive as being lacking in our life and our world is really a gap in God's love that we're perceiving. And and what do you fill that with? You know, if it's a gap and it's missing love, what do you fill it with? Well, duh.
Confetti.
Confetti. Water balloons.
When you said the word gap, somehow when my wife Nancy and I were in the UK, the only time we've been to England together, we took the London tube system, and on some of the trains, the stations of the light rail that they call the tube there, the rail tracks curve around a little bit as they're going through the station, and because of that, because the platform, they don't curve the platform exactly because it would basically be the engineering, you know, challenge to do that. But, you know, it's just a very slight curve. But they have signs, next to the where you get on and off the train there that say, mind the gap. And then there's this sort of Orwellian voice over this loudspeaker when the doors open. It says, mind the gap.
Wow.
Mind the gap. And I don't know if you've ever, you know, heard that, you know, featured elsewhere. But it just sounded like this. Yeah, I say Orwellian because it's sort of this deep voice. At least when we were there, it was this, I don't know, it's been, gosh, at least probably a better part of 20 years, maybe 20, more than 20 years ago. Anyway, but it was just this great, you know, sort of almost perfect sci-fi Orwellian, said, mind the gap, you know, sort of like, anyway. But we just thought it was a really cool sound. So we actually went back one BART station, or not BART.
You're in San Francisco.
Place in the Bay Area. But one tube station to try to record it, and the recording didn't turn out, but you can probably find it online. But I think I've seen T-shirts of it. But what a reminder, because, you know, if we can mind the gap and be mindful of the apparent separation and notice that that's an ego strategy, and be mindful of, you know, which teacher we've chosen when we experience any kind of gap, that's actually really good advice, to mind the gap. Of course, we have to mind it with the right teacher. That's always the challenge. If we mind it with the ego, we're going to be fearful. And if we mind it with the Holy Spirit, we'll be at peace, because we'll realize that the way to find joy in a joyless place is to discover that you're not there. Your identity isn't in the world, it's in the mind.
That's right. And that there is no gap.
Exactly.
All these things that we assume, and that's, I was just on the Miracles Live call, and we were talking about the, you know, the gap is something that we assume is there because we don't perceive the actual fabric of what is. And the actual fabric of what is God, is love.
Yeah.
And there is no gap in that. So, you know, if you're thinking that there is, and you're thinking, well, this certainly isn't a manifestation of God's love. Look at how awful this person is, or look at what a bad situation this is. It's because you're not minding the gap. You're looking for division, and you're looking for the differences. And Jesus tells us throughout the course, look for the sameness. Look for the things that are the same. And you will find that everything, you know, once you get to looking for it, you'll find that everything is the same. It may appear to be different because, you know, we have a definition or a condition or an idea of what is right and what is not, and what is good and what is not, what is bad. But, cool, thank you. but the reality of it is, that's an idea. It's a thought that God doesn't exist in that place.
Right.
You know, that's all we're thinking. God isn't in that. But, you know, God's in everything I see, because where is God? In my mind.
Exactly. So it always boils down to the Course, as in A Course in Miracles, is always and only about the mind, because that's where we heal the gap, not in the realm of form or space or time or bodies or personas or, you know, the whole anything having to do with the ego's thought system of projected unreality. So, yeah.
Yeah, and we can do that consciously. It doesn't have to be, God, show me how this works. You can actually do it consciously, and I was reminded of Mr. Rogers, whose mother told him when things are going wrong to look for the helpers. To look, you know, if there's an earthquake or a tsunami or the house burns down or whatever, look for the helpers. Look for what comes to you what people come to you, what resources come to you. You know, these things are all given to you to help you. And, you know, where it's not a perfect scenario, because we still perceive a gap, we can find the connection that closes the gap. And that's really all we're asked to do, is look for the connection to close the gap. And the connection is always love. And the gap, a call for love. The connection, the filling of the gap, is love. It's the only thing you can do. You know, if you perceive a lack of love, you perceive a call for love, then the only way to answer it is with love. And so that's what we in miracle workers get to do every day throughout our experience, is join with our Father in this loving place and mind the gap. Oh, there's Iris, and Iris is in London. I bet you Iris has heard that mind the gap on the trains. Maybe, maybe not.
I would imagine.
Anyway, good morning, everybody. Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson here with The Journey Home, and we are going through the book Ken Wapnick wrote called The Journey Home, and it's about a section of A Course in Miracles called The Obstacles to Peace. And so it's, you know, the obstacles to our journey home, the things that we put, the gaps that we perceive, the things that we think are holding us apart, keeping us apart. And so if we can mind the gap, then we can see that there really is no gap, and that the gap is so small, it's just easily blown away. That little pile, hill of dirt that Jesus talks about, and I always think, is when you sweep the floor with the broom, and you get the dustpan out, and you sweep the dust into the dustpan with the broom, and then when you're all done and you've swept and swept and swept, there's still a little line of dirt that didn't go in to the dustpan, that is the gap. I mean, that is the gap. And
I find it helpful to turn it 90 degrees and turn that row, you know, in a different direction, and then sweep it again.
So
and
you turn it from horizontal to vertical.
There's just maybe a speck or two of dust left, and then I figure, at that point, it's not worth it.
That's right. Or, you know, I lift up the rug under there, or or get the vacuum.
I have experience with that on a daily basis, because we have a litter box in the front bathroom, and when the cats, that's my duty, is I call it the covfefe duty, which is the covert feline feces, and so I get to do that cleaning. But there's always a few little bits of litter that get shaken off the bodies of our two cats, and so I have the covfefe clean up, and I get to good, the dustbin thing.
All right, now are you thinking, oh, here's God, or?
No, actually, I use it as an exercise to remind myself of how completely silly this world is, and to remember to laugh. You know that we've made up a world that requires these elaborate things that go in and out of bodies, and the absurdity and the bizarreness of it all, and just to laugh. It's very laughable. Oh, in fact, that reminds me, I resurrected a video that Craig Villarubia did the videography for when we were in Estes Park, Colorado a few years back. I was giving a presentation on the humor in A Course in Miracles. And so I found that video. I posted it on ACIblog.com, and it's there on the homepage if you want to check it out. And it's about an hour, and it was more of a monologue because that's how this conference was set up. So I started out with things that I thought were helpful in the course, and then I zoomed in and focused in on places where I put little smiley faces in my very much dog-eared and bookmarked and highlighted most recent version of a printed version of the course, but used that as the basis for about a 75-minute talk on the humor in A Course in Miracles and how Jesus very gently, very in a totally what's the best adjective I'm looking for? In a way that's not demeaning to anyone. It's completely kind-hearted, but he pokes completely kind-hearted, non-condemning fun at our choice for the ego.
Yes.
And there's many places in the course where that humor is really evident. So I just try to gather some of my favorites and try to fit them into an hour. So if anybody's interested in that, it's on ACIMblog.com along with a whole bunch of other stuff.
Very cool, because I remember that talk. I love that talk. And I was so glad, because I don't know if you knew this, but I was the one that suggested that we have you up there as a speaker. Because I enjoy you so much. I enjoy your take on things so much, and I was not disappointed. I love that talk.
And
so I'm glad that you got. I know Craig was out there videoing, and I know all those videos are on that YouTube channel. I should go and look them up, and because there was some really great talks at that workshop.
Oh yeah, very, very much so.
But yeah, that was one I really enjoyed.
Because
you really brought out the humor and how Jesus is gently laughing with us at our foibles and and how perfect it is and how we can gently laugh as well. Mm-hmm. And what a gift that is.
It really is. It really is to not take ourselves so seriously. And that helps us, one of the best tools possible of going beyond the obstacles to peace and looking at the gap, the imaginary gap, together with Jesus or the Holy Spirit, and seeing that there's nothing there.
Yep, it's just perfect. It's just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at my Kindle version of the book. We're 9% through this book already.
So 9%? Oh, yeah. We're smoking here.
There's no gap here.
I have this on the bottom of page 48 in the printed version.
Okay.
And I think we were going to reread the quote from chapter 28 in the text.
Yes, we were. And that's what, chapter 28 is where I was just reminded by someone in my group that Jesus talks about the gap. In that first section, the whatever of fear is a lot of talk about the gap, what it is, the undoing of fear. Mm-hmm. So this is from chapter 28 as well, section 1, the undoing of fear. So do you want to go ahead and read? And
sure.
Let's see. I'm going to see what my cat's at the door. I want to see what he wants.
Okay. All right. I'll dive into the first quoted part at the bottom of 48 for anybody who's reading along in The Journey Home by Dr. Ken Lovnick, subtitled The Obstacles to Peace of A Course in Miracles. So he has this quote from section 1, paragraph 4 of chapter 28. There's no link of memory to the past. If you would have it there, then there it is. But only your desire made the link, and only you have held it to a part of time where guilt appears to linger still. And then Ken's commentary begins, therefore, our interpretations would always come down to some belief that sin is real, whether it is in someone else or in ourselves. So the way out of it is to realize that what is upsetting me is not what I did or what others did. Rather, it is how I am looking at what they did. A Course in Miracles teaches us that perception is an interpretation, not a fact. And then he goes on to a theme to which we shall repeatedly return throughout this book. Acceptance of this teaching takes a lot of hard work, especially because we have all made some very powerful symbols of our guilt and our failures. The most trivial thing in the world could set us off. But then we can look back on it with the help of Jesus and realize the nothing that it really is. Therefore, it can have no effect on us if we change our interpretations, or to state it even more clearly, change the teacher who can instruct us about the meaning of what we behold. And he has a reference to chapter 31, section 7, paragraph 13 there. To state this another way, it is not the tiny mad idea of being separated from God that was the problem. It is not real. How could it be a problem? Rather, the problem was our choosing the ego's interpretation of the tiny mad idea instead of the Holy Spirit's. His gentle laughter, the humor again, would have undone and can still can undo the thought before the dream would have even begun. And that's a really pivotal point there, is that if we think that if there's changing anything in the world or changing anything in the ego's thought system or anything in our minds that is, you know, predicated or founded on ego thinking, let alone fixing the dream and putting a recovering dream repair technician's hat on again, we're barking at the wrong tree. We've got the ladder propped up against the wrong wall. We're just, as Einstein said, we're trying to solve a problem where it can't be solved. We have to get to the right place in order to solve the problem. Then it's easily solved. And that's what the Holy Spirit, a.k.a. our inner kindness teacher, helps us do is get to the right ladder against the right wall and choose the right approach, which is basically solve the problem where it can be solved, which is in the mind, and specifically in the mind being guided by Jesus, of Course in Miracles, or the Holy Spirit, or inner kindness teacher, or whatever label you want to put on. So,
well, yeah, and go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna check and see if you were back from cat duty.
Yeah, I opened the door and my husband was just walking out at the same time, so the cat followed him. So, okay. I was like, okay, perfect. but what I was gonna say with your with what you were saying is that the real thing that has to happen is we have to know what the real problem is. If we don't know what the problem is, then we can think the problem is many things. We can think the problem is, I don't have enough money, or I'm sick, or the wrong politician's in charge, or there's inequality and gaps all over the world, and everything seems to be wrong, but that's not the problem. And that's why lessons 79 and 80 are so important. Let me know what the problem is so it can be solved. Mm-hmm. Let me find out what the real problem is here. And when it comes down to it, the real problem is, as in this lesson today, is our perception that God is not everywhere. Our perception that God is somewhere else, and that somehow or the other God is not in my sickness. God is not in that bad politician. God is not in my burning house. God, we're just looking and seeing where God is not, and imagining that God is not in everything. And, that's kind of a simplistic way of looking at it, but it sure is easy to just say, well, no, God is here. Love is here. And this is, you know, whatever it appears to be to me is a manifestation of love. And so, you know, it's either love or a call for love. And so, you know, it's all the same thing. And so no matter what you think is going on, if you could just come back to that, you know, that this is love. And, you know, love may be that, you know, someone thinks that, you know, that something needs to be changed or fixed or redone or rearranged or whatever. That's a thought that something is lacking. And so, you know, constantly we're looking at the lack. We're looking at the gap. And we're not looking at the connection. But, do you know, I'm looking at this picture on my wall, which is right, it's huge. I have this huge poster on my wall. It's like 7 feet long, you know, wide, and, you know, maybe four feet high. So it's this huge poster of the God reaching out his finger to Adam, who's laying, you know, on a hill, a mountain somewhere, and giving him life. And there's a gap between the fingers. God's finger and Adam's finger are not touching, but there's a gap. But you know what? If you have a engine that you need to start, like a combustion engine that you need to start, like your car, what is it that makes that live when you turn the key on ignition, yeah, it sends a spark through the gap. And that gap, that spark running across that gap is what ignites the fuel, that the fumes of the fuel that start the motion of the combustion. So that gap is really not a gap. It is the opening for the spark. And so, you know, instead of looking and saying, well, there's no spark coming through my gap, all you have to do is turn the key. And, you know, if your battery's charged, it will send a spark through that gap and start that engine running. So,
Also, another aside, in the early days of radio, it was Marconi's, I think he was the one who made the first spark gap transmitter. And I tried this years ago, and of course it wreaks havoc with any radio device in the neighborhood if you do this. But you can, you know, if you have an old AM radio, which some people may still have around somewhere, I think they still exist in my imagination. you can, you know, prove this experiment to yourself pretty readily is if you find, you know, an old appliance that has, you know, contacts that need cleaning and sparks a little bit, like an old motor or something like that that's got commutators, whenever there's a spark, it'll make noise that gets picked up on radio, because a spark basically is electromagnetically will send out, you know, an energy in the electromagnetic spectrum, you know, across a very wide spectral range, and any device in the vicinity, and including around the world, if you have sensitive enough equipment, can pick it up, which is why that one of the first things done was to outlaw spark gap transmitters, because they basically broadcast everywhere to a certain extent, and you know, without getting too technical, but that's you know, that spark literally has the potential to radiate in a whole bunch of different frequencies. So that's why, you know, radio quickly became associated with tuning to a specific frequency, and then at the exclusion of all other frequencies. So here you get into a whole, we could talk about the whole idea of duality and the fact that there's different frequencies and wavelengths, but in truth, there's only the God frequency, which is infinite, and one, and all these other frequencies we made up are just, you know, poor substitutes, that kind of thing. So anyway, but.
Yeah, there you go. And also, as I'm looking at this picture and thinking about it, if it weren't for Adam with his hand out, with his arm reaching out, even though he's not really enthusiastic about it, If you ever look at this picture.
It's kind of a blasé pose, isn't it?
It is really blasé. If it wasn't for him actually having his arm reached out, there would be no ability for that spark to jump the gap. So
it'd be a whole different painting if he had his arms crossed and a pout on his face.
That's right. That's right. And God would just be saying, well, good. You just do it that way. No, God would not do that. But yeah, it's the being open for the receiving is just as important. So if your radios were not available to receive that, then you would never hear a sound. There would be no music. So that's all we're doing is perceiving gaps and allowing God to fill them. If you perceive a gap in any part of your life, just know that, you know, it's not real. That God is always reaching out, always has his hands outstretched to us and is always sending us that spark. And it's just, you know, my decision to receive it or not that can cause the make the difference.
I think before we leave that classic painting, which I can picture vividly in my mind only because it's so ubiquitous, it's interesting the symbolism, you know, from conventional, you know, particular Christianity, you know, the formal religion, as Ken would say, is that, you know, somehow the spirit enters the world through that gap and through that spark, through whatever, and that the world somehow now contains spirit. And of course, miracles is, you know, one of the few systems of thought in the world that, you know, the only one that I know of, other than perhaps Advaita Vedanta and maybe a few others that suggest that, you know, there's really nothing in the world that really has that or is that, and they're all substitutes, and in particular, they're attempted coups, if you will, or takeovers of, you know, the authority problem that the Course in Miracles talks about, of saying, okay, now we don't need you, God, because we've got, you know, spirit in this world. So it's really, you know, two very different thought systems that you could use to look at that classic painting with. And, you know, and it suggests that, you know, we're all spirit because there isn't any separation. But from the point of view of separation, it appears that that perfect oneness, which really is not a religious concept, well, at least it doesn't seem to be a very prevalent one, has somehow imparted that all the qualities of itself to duality, but that is never going to happen. I mean, that just is not, you know, there's nothing in this world that's ever going to make us happy, but we can be happy in the world by recognizing that our identity has never been imparted or you know, given to something that could be limited by form. It has always remained in its pristine, pure, intact state, and as of course Miracle says, you know, not a single note in heaven song was missed, which of course is a metaphor for, you know, the fact that we're all part of that perfect oneness and an inseparable and indivisible and indistinguishable part of that perfect oneness. And to try to separate it out with whatever gap we can imagine, whatever metaphor, is ultimately fruitless and ludicrous. But as Ken points out, it's not sinful, evil, or wicked. It's just silly.
Just silly. That's
just
right.
Silly.
And you have
and
to learn that.
Forgivable, right?
It's perfectly forgivable and forgiven completely. And so, you know, when we talk about in the obstacles to peace, you know, Jesus talks about that peace flows over everything. That peace actually fills in all the gaps. And if you are, you know, say you're baking a cake, and you have your pan, and you have your batter, and you pour your batter in the pan, if you watch it, it will flow over and completely cover the bottom of the pan if you have enough batter or whatever. But it'll completely, you're not going to have holes in your cake because that it, there was gaps where the batter didn't flow. That's how I think about it when I think, or like fog settling down over an area. It fills in all the gaps. It fills in all the gaps. And that's love. That's God. That God is here in everything, filling in all the gaps. And, you know, if we're perceiving gaps, it's because we're looking at it from the opposite direction, where there is a possibility of lack. There's a possibility that there's a hole there somewhere. So, you know, just whenever you feel like something is gone wrong or caused you any kind of problems, and Greg Witham sends me a message. Remember that Chicago song, Another Spark and Another Lonely Sunday? That's pretty funny. But that's what it is. There's no gap because love flows across everything and fills in every hole.
But there couldn't possibly be a gap in perfect oneness. And that's our real nature. And that's why, you know, it's helpful to, as quickly as we can, recognize that there's nothing in the dream world that's going to resolve the apparent gap. And, you know, all of our searching through relationships of every sort and through, you know, external seeking of every kind, you know, ultimately is fruitless because we already have it all. We already are it all. But we don't know that until we look at the ego without condemnation and just say, oh, this isn't working. Look at it with a humor and just say, this is pretty silly. Why would I try something that I know is never going to work when I'm honest with myself?
That's right. And why do we keep doing it? Because we honestly don't, we honestly believe our picture of the world is the right picture. And that Jesus' picture of the world is just a story or an idea or a thought, but it's the opposite. The truth is God is everywhere and in everything. So if you're not experiencing that, it's because you are not open to the love. You're not open to see it. So anyway, shall we continue?
Sure.
All right. Did you finish which paragraph?
The one that ends in before the dream would have even begun.
All right, well, I'm going to read then. It is also helpful to keep in mind that if you remember something in the past that upset you, whether it was last week, last month, or last year, or when you were a child, think about the incident and realize how silly it all was. It was not silly at the time because, to state it again, you made a connection of interpretation of victimization that upset you. And it is this interpretation that was and is the problem, not the situation itself. Since the past no longer exists, the whole matter boils down to the mistaken idea that we have sinned and therefore are no good, and that we have to, turn the page, protect ourselves from the enormity of our sin by making up the world that seems to be outside us. That is why we have such a strong investment in believing that the world is real. It, quote, protects us from confronting our own sinfulness, which in turn protects our individuality. And this also explains why so many people can study A Course in Miracles for years and years and just not recognize that it is saying that God did not create this world. Because if he did create the world, then psychologically we are off the hook. But if he did not create the world, then we did. What follows then is now the undefended memory that we made the whole thing up. Therefore, this must mean that it is not real and thus are driven back inside our minds to the sin and guilt that we truly believe about ourselves. This self-concept is summarized for us by the opening of Lesson 93. And Lesson 93 is, you know, when I read that, I said, Jesus knows me. And he knows my thinking.
Well, he knows everyone's ego because he went through that too and recognized that that was working and abandon it completely.
Exactly. So
he's just asking us to abandon it completely, and we're still hemming and hawing. Say, well, maybe there's still some parts of ego that might work.
Yeah, no, I still go back to believe in this stuff and on a daily basis. So, you know,
we're still defending. Oh, pardon me.
Go ahead.
Oh, as you say, we're still defending certain memories that are false memories. As I had that phrase circled underneath where I've underlined, God did not create this world. You know, because the undefended memory is really what allows us to look at, you know, honestly, the choices that, you know, that we've made that appear to create the material universe as a defense mechanism for an insane thought system, which was also unfounded but unconscious. So, you know, once we look at that, we don't defend when we're defenseless, we basically are saying, okay, Holy Spirit, let's look at this together, because if I look at it with the ego, I'm going to look in a defended state of mind, and I'm not going to want to let go of, you know, what I see that isn't working. But if I'm undefended, Holy Spirit will just gently point out, say, hey, look at this. Hey, that doesn't work, does it? No. No, you're right. It doesn't work, does it? Hey, I can let this go. Give you a piece. I can see pieces of this.
Yeah.
Never upset for the reason I think.
Exactly. When you look at the past and you look at all the sins of the past, you look at the things that happened to you, like he's suggesting, when you were a child, and this is some work that... Diedrich Walsack and the Choose Again, this is work that they do, is, you know, you look at these thoughts that you have about yourself, that you're not worthy, or you're whatever it is that you think, and, you know, he asks you, you know, think about this, and think about the first time you ever felt this way about yourself. Think about the first time you ever had this idea about yourself. And, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, when I was, you know, 3 years old and I was having a hard time and I wanted to sit in my dad's lap and have him comfort me, but he was busy doing something else, so he kind of pushed me aside and told me to go play. And with that, I felt like, you know, my feelings have no meaning and, you know, my dad doesn't love me. And, you know, you get all these thoughts in your head, even at a very early age, that the reason for that action on your father's part was because of you. You were the bad person. And it may be that your dad was just tired. He just got home from work. He wanted to relax. You know, he was, you know, doing something and he didn't have, you know, you couldn't sit in his lap because he was busy, you know, eating or driving or whatever it is that, you know, he happened to be doing. But in your childish mind, you interpret it as rejection. And so in our childish mind, we still remember that. And then every time we ever have that feeling again, it's a reaffirmation that we are rejectable, that we are unworthy, that, you know, someone, you know, our father doesn't love us. And so, you know, it could be anything that you remember from, you know, your early upbringing that put an idea into your mind that there was something wrong with you. And everything else then that happened to you in your life just reinforced that to you. But if you looked back and you said, oh, you know, my dad had just come home from work and he was tired and he just wanted to relax and watch TV and smoke a cigarette and drink his bourbon or whatever, which is what my dad would do, you know, come home, you know, get a drink. My mother would meet him at the door with a drink in her hand. So he started drinking from the moment he got home from work, and you know, that was his comfort. But for me, I'm thinking, oh, he doesn't love me. And so I totally misinterpret the reason, totally misinterpret it, and my whole life is based on that misinterpretation. But when I go back and reinterpret it and say, oh, you know, that was not, had nothing to do with me at all. That was, you know, him in his feelings. Then, you know, I realized that all these feelings of unworthiness that I've lived with my whole life are based on a story that is not true. And, you know, if you can do that with anything that comes up to you, it doesn't matter, you know, what it is. If you have feelings about yourself, feelings about your life and thoughts about, you know, what you are, those thoughts have been given to you by an incomplete or an not knowing the whole story. You're just seeing a part of it that you are involved in, and you think that's the whole picture. And when you reinterpret it and recognize, well, you know, he never, you know, did that. That was just my thinking. And you can let go of it. And then you can look at all the other times in your life that you acted and reacted based on that belief and see how mistaken you were. And, you know, the purpose is not
you can generalize.
Right, you can generalize it to your whole life. So, you know, the thing is not to say, wow, you know, I'm bad because I misinterpreted that. The thing is to say, that was not what happened at all. That was not what happened at all.
And we're not denying the physical experience or the sensory data. We're just basically choosing to use the Holy Spirit's translation, which basically is guilt-free, and reminds us of everyone's innocence, that essentially evaporates the ego's incorrect, but basically just silly misinterpretation of events and things in the world.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, if you can do that on a regular basis, and anytime these things come up in your mind, if you can just look at it and see the truth of it and recognize that, you know, what you thought happened never did,
mm-hmm.
then and you're going to find that every single time. There is nothing that happened the way I thought it did, ever. Because what I thought was, it was my interpretation of a physical action or a word or a thought. But that's not true, and it never has been. You know, then you're open for a new interpretation. And that's all we're asking for. That's all Jesus is asking for, is open yourself for a new interpretation of what you are. That's the miracle, to be able to see it differently.
Mm-hmm.
So this lesson 93, this first paragraph of it, is my experience, and I bet it's probably the experience of just about everybody else who's here listening. You know, I can't even imagine that there are people in the world that don't have this interpretation of themselves. And so Jesus says, you think you are the home of evil, darkness, and sin. You think if anyone could see the truth about you, he would be repelled, recoiling from you as if from a poisonous snake. You think if what is true about you were revealed to you, you would be struck with horror so intense that you would rush to death by your own hand, living on after seeing this being impossible. That's lesson 93, paragraph 1. And what is the actual name of that lesson?
Light, peace, and joy abide in me.
Yeah, light, peace, and joy abide in me.
Off the bat, he says, you got to get a looking at the things in the way, you know, the obstacles to peace, in order for those to be a valid experience for you, and not just something you're, you know, wishful thinking kind of thing. Because otherwise, you know, we're just basically kidding ourselves if we don't look at the ego with the Holy Spirit, because that's the only way it's going to be dissolved, is by patiently forgiving ourselves for all the craziness in the world, and just say, this is not my real identity, nor is it anyone else's. And from there, we can embrace, you know, infinite compassion, but only with practice, and only with, you know, allowing ourselves to be led to generalize that to everyone and everything through, you know, typically years, decades, lifetimes, perhaps, of practice. But we can speed up the process enormously. And at some point, you know, the more we practice, the less we're concerned about, you know, the time frame, because we're peaceful more and more often, and we know we can return to that anytime we want by choosing, you know, Holy Spirit's, you know, translation of things rather than ego's misinterpretation of things. And all I got to do to return to peace is just switch teachers. There's the, you know, let me look at the problem so it can be solved, and let me recognize the problem has been solved. And 78 and 79 workbook lessons, right? As you're pointing out earlier, Lynn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So light and peace and joy abide in me. Or
that's the truth of us, but we have to look at all the darkness that we believe about ourselves, whether consciously or not, first, and, you know, bring it out on the altar of, the, of our mind. And, you know, it, sometimes it feels like, you know, dragging out this, you know, this thing in a body bag and unzipping it and laying it on the, you know, the examination table that, you know, the Close Encounters intensity floodlight coming down with the spirit saying, wow, look at this. This horrible monster, and then before we can finish the sentence, you know, the word, it's like it vaporizes. If we look at it with the Holy Spirit, it's like there's nothing there.
Yeah.
But we have to look at it first. We have to see, you know, the full gory detail of what we've made things to be. And, you know, it usually takes a little longer than it is. But you know, it does vaporize. It basically, once we look at it and shine the light on the things we made up from all these different angles, it goes away because there's nothing there in truth. The light being the light of the eternal awareness of what we really are, symbolically and metaphorically, that then, you know, if we can illuminate something from every angle, there's no darkness. There's only shadow when we believe that we can, you know, have light and shadow. And in this world, that's the norm. In fact, I, you know, occasionally have opportunities to do product photography. I've photographed the 27 different editions of the translations of the A Course in Miracles and some of their, you know, digital versions and so forth. And I have this little thing called a light box. Studio in a box, I guess it's called, and the idea is to simulate as close as you can light that comes from all angles, so to eliminate the shadows. And when you do that, you know, when things are beautifully illuminated like that, you really can focus on the content rather than on the shadow, and because, you know, the shadows can be just distracting. But if you can just see just the content, it obviously then the differences disappear metaphorically. I'm just using that as an example of you know, something in the material world that sort of has some metaphors going on there. So
yeah, that's exactly it. So you want to? We still have time to read a couple more paragraphs before our end.
Yeah. Okay. The contrast between the reality of what God created and the illusory nature of what we made is succinctly summarized by this statement, which comes at the end of the introduction to the text. I'm sure every Course student is familiar with this by now. The Course can therefore be summed up very simply in this way: nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, herein lies the peace of God. And he omitted the italics and boldface. And then so Kent's comment is, so the whole world then becomes a smokescreen and a defense against having to look within ourselves. Because, once again, if we did make up the world and God did not, then it means that the purpose of the world is also in our minds, along with the awesome guilt and horrifying thought of God's vengeance. Enter Holy Spirit's examination table with the bright uniform illumination, right? That is precisely why we have such a tremendous investment and need to deny these thoughts. In the context of the section, our investment in self-protection develops into the tremendous need to keep attack real. So we'll go into that more next week. So, any comments on that before we wrap it up for today?
Okay, I'll come turn it on in a minute.
Are you still there, Lynn? I'm just going to, maybe you're just walk away from it. I'm just going to say thank you.
I am still here. I'm sorry. My grandson was at the door. He wants me to come down and give him some breakfast. So.
Not a problem. I did run off, too. Anyway, just thank you, as always, Lynn, for another enjoyable hour sharing from A Course in Miracles and the inspiration of Ken Wapnick in particular with our continued reading of The Journey Home. And you can always reach me at acimblog.com. And if anybody hasn't checked out that most recent post that I put up there about the humor in the Course, you might enjoy that. That was from Estes Park a few years back.
Yeah, and it was brilliant. So please go and check it out, acimblog.com. And check out that beautiful Miracles in the Mountains. It wasn't really Miracles in the Mountains, but it was It was exactly that up in Estes Park, Colorado. So
I think that was called Weekend of Freedom Retreat.
Weekend of Freedom, that's right.
The name of that particular event, yeah.
Yeah, so very good. Well, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. And
likewise,
we will talk to you next week, and hopefully we won't have the gap.
That's right. We'll be mindful of the gap.
Mindful of the gap. Mind the gap. All right, you guys. I love you all. Thank you again, Bruce. And I'm going to turn the mic over to you, Carrie and Iris. And Iris, I hope your pal talk is working. The mic is all yours.